Well, in Genesis 34 that we looked at last week, this train wreck of a chapter where Jacob disobediently goes to Shechem, and you know the whole travesty of what happened there. And he decides, okay, I need to go back. I need to follow through on God's commandment to go to my father and to go back south to see my brother. And so in chapter 35, verse 1, God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from Esau, your brother." So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Discard the alien gods that are in your midst. Cleanse yourselves and change your clothes. Then come, let us go up to Bethel. I will make there an altar to God who answered me in my time of distress and was with me on the road that I traveled." So they gave to Jacob all the alien gods that were in their possession, as well as the rings that were in their ears. And Jacob buried them underneath the terebinth near Shechem. They set out, and there fell a godly terror on the cities which were around them, so that they did not pursue Jacob's sons. Let me suggest something to you. If you have suffered some terrible sin, you have really taken a turn in your spiritual walk with the Lord. You've disobeyed, you've totally messed up. You've goofed big time. Let me suggest to you that you take these five verses and ponder them, meditate on them, study them, go before the Lord with them. Because I think what you find here in these five verses is the formula for someone who has disobeyed, and we all have, sometimes in our lives very seriously. And this is the formula for coming back to God. I'm not going to take time tonight to expound on every one of these. I think it's more important for you to study these on your own. But let me just point out a few things to give you a little bit of guidance about how you might go about looking into these verses. The first thing God says to Jacob is, arise. In other words, get back on your feet. Now, depression, which is something that seems like so many people suffer from in this day and age, is a pretty easy thing to come by and a pretty comfortable place to stay, because you have an excuse to do nothing. And I think some people who are in depression really aren't that concerned about getting out of it. Because depression is like a warm wool blanket that just you wrap around yourselves. It protects you from everything on the outside. It cuts off the light. You're all alone, and it's a protection to you. And it's a place where people sometimes just want to stay. I say, quit. And I say, arise. Stand back up again. And then go to Bethel. What does that mean? Well, God had originally commanded Jacob to go to Bethel, but he decided to go north instead of south. He decided to go to Shechem instead. And what a tragedy that was. And so there's a city full of dead people there because of what happened. So what you need to do is turn around. That's what repent means. Turn around. Teshuvah. To turn about. And go back the way you're supposed to go. Pick up where you left off. Where did you veer off path? Go back and then get back on the path again. Bethel means house of God. It doesn't mean church. It means the place where God dwells. And you know where God dwells? Here. God dwells in your obedience. God dwells in a surrendered heart. And God does dwell in a community of people who are certainly seeking His face. Make an altar there. This is the first place in the Bible where someone's commanded to build an altar. We've seen a lot of altars built up to this point. The first time God commands it. And here's an important thing I think we need to straighten out in our thinking. Too many times in testimonies I've heard people say, "I was addicted to drugs or alcohol, but I put that on the altar." Or, "I was into this thing or that thing, but I put those things on the altar." You know what? You don't put your junk on the altar. You put yourself on the altar. And if you're trying to get rid of a habit or some kind of addiction or whatever it is that's messing up your life, you don't put that on the altar. You put holy things on the altar. And every sacrifice is performed, the rabbis tell us, that unless you see that sacrifice as being you, it doesn't accomplish anything. You need to put yourself on the altar. Remember how we were looking last week about Jacob and the way God dealt with the whole problem of the spirit and the flesh? Is that God didn't deal with the flesh. He broke the man himself. And when he dealt with Jacob, when he dealt with the soul, the flesh was not a problem anymore. So God doesn't want you putting your junk on the altar. He wants you repenting of it and putting yourself on the altar. And when you do that, the habit isn't a habit anymore. The distraction is not a distraction anymore. It's you God wants to deal with. He wants holy things placed there. So you need to make an altar to God who appeared to you when you fled from Esau, your brother. Why did Jacob flee from his brother? Fear. And I find that pretty much all sin has its origins in fear. I mean, we could also argue it has it in pride. But I look back at Adam and Eve, and I've said this before, we were studying the whole thing about the garden and the meeting of the fruit, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. I think pretty much every sin goes back to a fear that if I don't do this sin, I'll be missing out on something. That's the lure I see the enemy using. That's what he's used in my life. He's probably used it in yours. This fear that God's holding out on me, and if I obey God, I'm going to miss out on something. Isn't that true? So we need to deal with our fears. Our fears will turn us into to creatures we don't even recognize. So anyways, last week, I'm not going to go over last week's teaching about fear. You can listen to that later if you like. And then so Jacob said to his household and to all who were with them, discard the alien gods in your gods that are in your midst. We're not told how these alien gods got into their midst. They just have a way of getting into our midst. And they can kind of get in there without us really realizing, wait a minute, what is this thing in my life that I fear, that I'm giving my fear to, and my attention, my worship, and time to? How did it get here? That's not God. And we need to chuck it out. We need to leave it behind. Leave it in Shechem. Leave it behind you. And so they discarded their gods. He said, cleanse yourselves. Change your clothes. You know, when you stand up, you cleanse yourself, you change your clothes, it's kind of like a picture of a whole new you. Let's start new here. Put everything behind us. Let's move ahead. Verse 4, so they gave to Jacob all the alien gods that were in their possession, as well as the rings that were in their ears. Now, it's not saying here that earrings are a sin. We know for a fact that Abraham's servant, Eliezer, gave earrings to Rebekah when he met her. And so it's not that earrings are a sin. But, you know, sometimes animals are led around by a ring in their nose or a ring in their ear. And we know that when a bondservant, when his 7 years were up, that he was free to leave, if he decided to stay with his master, what was done to make him belong to his master forever? An awl was put through his ear into the mezuzah, to the doorpost, or into the door. So earrings, the place of hearing, is the place of obedience. And apparently these earrings are things they'd picked up in Shechem. They'd picked up along the way, and they were reminders of that past life. And so what we do, we take the rings of our ears, the controls the enemy has on us. Whoever has your ear has your obedience. What's interesting is in Hebrew and in Greek as well, the word for obedience and the word for hear are almost identical. In fact, in Greek they are the identical word, akouo. To hear is to obey. So who's got your ears? Who's scratching your itchy ears, you know? Who are you giving your ear to? So they gave all these things, they buried them there, and then look what the result is in verse 5. A godly terror. A godly terror. You know, I know people who are afraid of believers, but often it's not a godly terror, not a godly fear. And I've been in places where leaders can have such a control over the congregation they're in terror of him, but it's not a godly terror. And you know, I've had some neighbors that were so religious and so fanatical, I was kind of afraid of them, but it was not a godly terror. But when you're obeying God, when you're living for him and walking his path, there's an awareness in those around you that you're different. And they needed God's protection because they were marked men. They just wiped out a city. And they had done it in rebellion to God. No question about it. There's no defending what they did. But when they repented, God gave them something they didn't deserve. He gave them protection by allowing a godly fear, a respect to fall on all those around. And they didn't bother Jacob and his sons as they left. You know what? We are sometimes so busy protecting ourselves, we forget about God. And our protection of ourselves is pretty worthless. But when we make Him our fortress, when we make Him our mighty tower of defense, then our enemies don't have to deal with us. They have to deal with the tower. You see? So when you make Him your fortress, I love Psalm 91. When you dwell in the place of the Most High, when you make Him your... What's the other word that's used there? It's fortress and... help me out. I'm old. My mind's going. This strong tower, a stronghold, but you make Him that. The people have to deal with Him. They don't have to deal with you. You see? So if we follow Him, He becomes our defense. That's an amazing principle. If we can just lay hold of that, we don't have to live so afraid. Well, let's move on. I just suggest to you that you study those verses. If you're trying to recover from a fall, a moral fall, someplace you got off track with God, I think if you study these, God will use these verses to speak to you and give you a guidance how to get your life back on track. Well, let's move on. We're at verse 6. Thus Jacob came to Luz in the land of Canaan. It is Bethel. Remember what happened at Bethel before? 20-some years earlier, Jacob was leaving home, heading to Paddan Aram, and his brother Esau had vowed to kill him, so he's leaving. And he comes to this place, and he has a dream of the ladder. Remember? And God speaks these wonderful, wonderful blessings and promises to him, and says He will bring him back here. So here he is, finally. After all these years, he's come back. He and all the people who are with him. To think that he went out all by himself, and he comes back. He's got 4 wives, 11 sons, one on the way, sheep, cattle, camels, servants, maidservants. And he comes back, he's like this multitude of people returning. God had certainly blessed him. And it says in verse 7, and he built an altar there and called the place El Bethel. Before he called it Bethel, house of God, but now it's called God of the house of God. I think there's an interesting progression here. I think as young believers, we get really excited about Bethel, the house of God, the things of God, the people of God. We get excited about the rituals that might be involved, and all the trappings of God. And somehow in that, we haven't quite discovered the El Bethel, the God of the house of God. We can become like book collectors who are so interested in collecting rare volumes we never have time to read. Or a stamp collector who never mails a letter. All right? A classic car collector who doesn't know how to drive. We can become people who are so religious and into church things or synagogue things, we don't have time for God. But Jacob had been through a lot. And before he was impressed with the place, now he's impressed with the God of the place. El Bethel. For it was there that God had been revealed to him during his flight from his brother. And then it tells us about how Deborah had passed away. We may touch on that next week. But I want to move right on to verse 9. And God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Paddan Aram, and he blessed him. Then God said to him, your name is Jacob. Your name shall not always be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. Thus he called his name Israel. I know this sounds like a repeat of what he had done earlier in the wrestling match. But it seems like Jacob is always in the wrestling match in becoming Israel. Because God says, your name's not going to be Jacob anymore, but Israel. But then a few verses later, God's calling him Jacob again. And then maybe a little later, maybe Israel. But then Jacob and Jacob and Jacob. Then he says, your name's going to be Israel. And they'll call him Israel, but then a little bit later, he's calling him Jacob again. Sounds like my life. you know, God tells me who I am in the scriptures, but then I trip up, you know, it's like, oh, I haven't learned anything. It's I'm always wrestling to move from being a Jacob, a heel, to being an Israel, a prince of God. And I think Jacob's struggle is our struggle. This is why the people of God are not called the Abrahamites or the Isaacites, but the Israelites. Because this individual, Abraham's grandson, most accurately pictures the struggle that we all have. We should all aim to be an Abraham, but most of us spend most of our lives as Jacob. But God loves us and He blesses us anyway. And He's determined to make us an Israel. And you look at the things He took Jacob through. It wasn't easy turning Jacob into an Israel. But we go on to the next verse, verse 11. And God said to him, I am El Shaddai. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a congregation of nations shall descend from you, and kings shall issue from your loins. The land that I gave to Abraham and to Isaac, I will give to you, and to your offspring after you, I will give the land. Then God ascended from upon him in the place where he'd spoken with him. I want us to pay attention to verse 11, and this is where we're going to spend the evening. God said to him, I am El Shaddai, be fruitful, multiply, a nation and a kahal is the Hebrew word used there. Kahal, a kahal of nations. Now, what is this word kahal? Now, those of you who have studied Hebrew, you know already. Just don't tell the person next to you. They may not know yet. And I want to have the pleasure of surprising them. And I need a piece of paper to cover up all my... Oh, here we go. This will work. There's the word kahal. All right? Three letters in Hebrew. Kahal. It's like alcohol without the al, all right? Kahal. Now, one of the problems in studying the scriptures is this. First of all, the scriptures are ancient. Second of all, they're written in two different languages, three if you count the Aramaic. You've got the Hebrew scriptures written in Hebrew, and then you've got the New Testament scriptures written in Greek. And what we tend to do is this. You know, words change in meanings over time. Now, as long as you and I agree on what a word means, we can use that word and communicate without any trouble. But if we don't agree on what the word means, then we have all kinds of problems. Men tend to use words differently from women, and this causes a lot of problems. Generations, you know, parents and children tend to use words in different ways, and this causes communication problems. What happens when we have scriptures that are 2,000 to 4,000 years old? We're trying to understand them. The only way to understand them is to go back and find out what the word meant originally to the writer and stick with that definition. We cannot change it. What we tend to do is we take a word and it changes and evolves and whatever, and then finally it comes to mean this in our day and time. And then when we see that word in our translations, we apply this definition to this ancient word. It doesn't work. We get in all kinds of problems that way. So let's look at this word kahal. The word kahal is found first in Genesis 28:3. In Genesis 28:3. And this word starts out not with Abraham, not with Isaac, but with Jacob. In Genesis 28:3, it states, God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you that you may become a kahal of peoples. This is Isaac blessing his son Jacob before he left. Now when Abraham is blessed by God, God doesn't use this word. For example, Genesis 17:5. God says, no longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. But it doesn't use the word kahal. Kahal begins with Jacob. Now this first appearance in Genesis 28:3 is when Jacob had nothing, and when his name was just Jacob. Now, 20-some years later, we find the second use of this word in the passage we've read this evening in chapter 35. And this is when, again, God is reemphasizing that you're not Jacob, you're Israel. And now Jacob has everything. Now, why do I say Jacob had everything? Remember a couple of weeks ago when Jacob and Esau finally meet, and Jacob's giving Esau all these flocks and everything, and Esau says, "Oh, you keep it. I have plenty." But Jacob responds, "No, you take it. I have everything." So here's the second use of this word, kahal. Now, the word kahal is the word that eventually evolved into the word church. And one of the things that people are so stunned by when they begin to study the Hebrew roots of our faith is the fact that so many words they thought were Christian words aren't. I remember last year when I was teaching a Bible class at a high school, a Christian high school co-op. And these are all kids from church backgrounds. I said, "I want you to list a lot of church words for me." And they didn't know what I meant, so I put like the word church and the word baptize and the word communion. And it just started going. You know, they listed all these words, sanctification, redemption, salvation. And they went through all this list of words. And we took the entire list. There's a dozen or more words there. I said, "You know, every single one of these did not start in the New Testament." I went through. This one started in Genesis. This one started in Leviticus. That one's in Genesis. There are a couple here from Exodus. Every single word they had on the board, none of them were Christian terms. They were all Old Testament, Jewish, Hebrew terms, including the term church. Okay? Church starts with Jacob in Genesis 28. Got it? We need to get that drilled in because it changes everything. We tend to think, as Gentiles, that church is something that started with Jesus, and we need to try to get Jews into it. I have news for you. A clear reading of the New Testament shows the church started with Jacob, and we as Gentiles get grafted into it. And when your mind turns right side up on this subject, not upside down, right side up, the whole Bible changes. And you know, we could take all the other words too, the words for baptism and communion and sanctification and redemption and salvation. And if we go back to the ancient meanings, the ancient use of these words, they make all kinds of sense then. But again, you know, it's not all our fault either. We're reading a book that's 2,000 to 4,000 years old, and the first part's written in Hebrew, and then those words have to be brought over into another language, Greek, and then they need to be brought into a third language, English. So we've had a lot of hurdles, a lot of filters that these words have had to pass through. But what I want us to understand here is a concept of church history as you've never heard it, but the way it's always been in the Scriptures. Now, I'm not going to give you every reference where the word kahal is found in the Hebrew Scriptures. It's found dozens and dozens, probably over 100 times. I didn't count them, but it's found lots of times in the Bible. It's a very common word. And what it means is a congregation, a group of people are called together. It means all those things are usually applied to the word ecclesia, the Greek word for church. Called out ones, called together ones, a congregation, an assembly of people who come together for a purpose. It has the exact same definition, no different. In fact, in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, they substitute ecclesia for the word kahal. Okay, so it's just a simple translation. But we have to understand church didn't start in Matthew 16 when Jesus said, "Upon this rock I will build my church." Because you'll notice when you read that, none of the apostles said, "Church? What's that? That's new. Master, please tell us, what is this thing you call church?" They didn't do that. They all knew what he's talking about. There was nothing new. The whole idea of kahal was something they had been trained in. It's something they loved. It was a familiar word to them. And they realized Yeshua had come to have a profound effect upon the kahal. And he was the cornerstone of it himself. So, I'm just picking out a few passages here to give us a feel for this word in the Hebrew. Genesis 48, 3 to 4. A wonderful passage. This is Jacob again, and he's prophesying. Now, in chapter 49, he's going to prophesy over every one of his sons. But in 48, Joseph comes, you know, the beloved son. Joseph comes with his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And if you turn to Genesis 48, we'll start in verse 3. It says, "Then Jacob said to Joseph, 'God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me.'" Now there he's referring back to when he's fleeing from Esau and he had the dream of the ladder. And he's also referring to chapter 35 right here, where he's now come back to Luz or Bethel, and God has blessed him again. And Jacob goes on in 48:4. "And he said, God said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and numerous, and I will make you a kahal of peoples, an assembly of peoples, of called out peoples, and will give this land to your descendants after you for an everlasting possession.'" Now look what Jacob says. Verse 5, "Now as for your two sons, who were born to you in the land of Egypt, before I came to you in Egypt, they will be mine. Ephraim and Manasseh will be mine, just as Reuben and Simeon are." Now in this chapter, a little bit later in Genesis 35, we're going to find out how Reuben lost his birthright. Again, we'll probably save that for next week. Simeon, we know how Simeon and Levi lost their birthrights by murdering everybody in Shechem last week, chapter 34. So the birthright's been passing down. But he's telling Joseph here, "Your two sons, you're my son Joseph, but your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, they are going to be adopted by me, not as my grandsons, but as my sons." This is why we find the tribe of Ephraim and the tribe of Manasseh, right along the tribe of Reuben and Dan and Simeon and all the rest. Okay? Verse 5, "Any children that you father after them will be yours. They will be listed under the names of their brothers and their inheritance." But these two, in other words, Joseph, you get a double portion. Instead of you being one tribe, you become two tribes. Your sons each become one. I adopt them as my own sons. They are being grafted in a very special way. Now remember, Ephraim and Manasseh, they did not have a Jewish mother. Their mother did not come from where Rebekah and Rachel had come from, and Leah and the other matriarchs of Israel. Their mother was an Egyptian. You see? And according to the modern Jewish tradition, if your mother is not Jewish, you're not Jewish. To be Jewish, you have to prove that your mother is Jewish. If you want to move to Israel, you have to prove that your mother is Jewish. And if your mother's Jewish, you're Jewish. Well, Joseph's boys had a Gentile mom. They were Gentiles. But God says, "I'm grafting them in." Jacob says, "I'm grafting them into me. They're going to be called by my name." It's a powerful picture. And he does this in the context of God saying to him, "I'm going to make you a kahal of peoples." I love Psalm 22. Now, what's Psalm 22 about? How many of you know your Psalms well enough to know what Psalm 22 is about? It was written 1,000 years before Yeshua's birth, but what is it a picture of? What is it? Crucifixion. Yeah, crucifixion had not even been invented yet. It wouldn't come along for centuries. But in Psalm 22, you see a detailed description of a crucifixion. In fact, won't you turn there for a moment? Psalm 22. One of my favorite studies that we've done at Beth Tikkun, it was done years ago. And we took a few weeks in the summer and we just took some psalms and we studied them. And one of my favorite studies is the one we did on Psalms 22 through, I think it was 28, no, 20, through 31, through half of 31. And this is all on the internet, so you can listen to them on the website if you want to. But look how Psalm 22 begins. My God, why have you forsaken me?" Yeah, where have we heard that before? You see, Psalm 22 starts with that, which Yeshua said on the cross. And when you go through Psalm 23, 24, 25, 26, on down to 31, verse 5, Psalm 31, verse 5 says, "Into your hand I commit my spirit." When you realize that Yeshua's quotes, his first and last quote, come from Psalm 22, Psalm 31, you begin to see that what he was doing on the cross was quoting through these psalms. And Psalm 22 describes crucifixion. And as you go through there, you look at verse 7, "All who see me sneer at me. They separate with the lip. They wag their head, saying, 'Commit yourself to the Lord. Let him deliver you. Let him rescue him, because he delights in him.'" Remember what the people did? They taunted him, "If you're the Son of God, come down off the cross. Let God deliver you." And you go on a bit further. He talks in verse 11 using some great imagery here. We don't have time to explain right now. "But be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. Many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. They open wide their mouth at me as a raven and a roaring lion. I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart's like wax. It smelled within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. My tongue cleaves to my jaws." Isn't that interesting? Look at verse 16. "For dogs have surrounded me." Dogs being a code word for Gentiles. "A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look, they stare at me. They divide my garments among them. And for my clothing, they cast lots." Remember, this is written 1,000 years before Yeshua's crucifixion. Powerful stuff, isn't it? You want to know what was in Yeshua's mind while he's on the cross? Study these Psalms from 22 through 31, verse 5. I tell you what, you want to see a glorious vision of what the crucifixion was about, what was in the mind of Messiah, and what was accomplished through his crucifixion. My goodness, this is wonderful, wonderful stuff to read. Well, anyways, if you go on down to verses 22 and 23, this is what it says. "I will tell of your name to my brethren. In the midst of the kahal, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob," there's Jacob again, "glorify him and stand in awe of him. All you descendants of Israel." See how the word kahal is again attached to Jacob and Israel? There's even a book in the Bible that's named after the kahal. It's a book of Ecclesiastes. Now remember, what's the Greek word for church? Ecclesia, from which we get Ecclesiastes. In Hebrew, it's called Kohelet, from the word kahal. You got it? Kahal is the gathering. The Kohelet is often translated the preacher. But see, here's another word. You know, preacher is an unfortunate word. When I say the word preacher, what do you picture in your mind? Someone standing behind a pulpit, not teaching, that'd be a teacher, but preaching, which means in a very energetic tone of voice, trying to convince people to do something. Do you know that idea of preaching has only been around for maybe 200 years, a little over? It's pretty much an American phenomenon. If you want to understand what it is, scripturally, what that word preacher is, it's an evangelist from the word evangelion, evangel, or gospel, Greek word for gospel. He's one who simply takes the gospel to those who have not heard it. If you're in a church building preaching at people who already know the gospel, there's no real description for you. You don't exist in the Bible. You know, you're trying to convert the converted. You're trying to sell Amway to people who are already signed up. It's like, what are you doing? We're to be teaching the flock, feeding the flock. Not trying to convince sheep to become sheep. They're already sheep, you know. It's they're in. They need to be fed now and protected. So But preaching is the word that came along in American English to describe these men who would go out and share the gospel. And that was used accurately. But what's happened in the churches, they kept being called preachers, preachers, preachers. And it got to be almost like a performance art. And it's and what has happened is over the centuries, last couple centuries, we've seen the Church of God, the Messianic and, you know, Sunday morning church. I'm not singling out one group. But we've seen a weakening. We've seen a weakening. You know? Because they are not being fed. They need to be fed and strengthened. When I talk to people, there's a young man, a great, great individual. I've had some really great emails and phone call. And up in Canada, he's beginning a Messianic congregation. And he sounds like he's really ready to get started. He's really thought this through. He's under authority, some godly men. And so he's asked me and some other people, just, I want to get counsel. What do I do? And one of the first things I shared with him was that you're going to be a shepherd. Shepherds don't reproduce sheep. Sheep reproduce sheep. See? Shepherds feed sheep, protect sheep. If the sheep are healthy, you can't keep them from reproducing. If they're not healthy, you don't want them reproducing. You follow? But if you're in a church or a messianic congregation, they're always, go out there and get going and tell people and bring them in and blah, blah, blah. Something's wrong. Something's just plain wrong. Healthy sheep reproduce naturally. Nobody has to tell them to do so. Sheep need fed. Sheep need fed and protected. So, in Ecclesiastes, or Kohelet, and the word there should not be preacher, but the summoner. Remember, kohol is a group of people who are gathered. And if you look in a Hebrew dictionary, a lexicon, the word that's used there is one who calls together, or a summoner summons people to the assembly. That's what a kohol is, an assembly. All right? And then we come to Matthew 16. So let's turn to Matthew 16. Again, I'm not giving you all the passages in which the word kohol is found, not by a long shot. Just giving you a sampling so you can get a feel for how this word is used. So let's go to Matthew 16. This is the first place in the New Testament where the word church is found, the word ecclesia. And it's a very, very insightful passage. So, we're going to go to Matthew 16. We'll start with verse 13. Now, when Yeshua came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he was asking his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they said, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, but still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. He said to them, but who do you say that I am? Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Yeshua said to him, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock, Petrus, I will build my church, and the gates of Sheol will not overpower it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Oh, that verse 19. Now, has that ever led to some real goofy theology? And so if people are going around trying to bind things and loose things and make Rolls Royces appear in their driveway, and oh my goodness, and it has nothing to do with that. He's using Jewish terminology that is very common in the ancient Jewish writings. And loosing and binding have nothing to do with making God do something or not do something that we want him to do or not do. It has nothing to do with that whatsoever. It's a whole different story. So you'll have to ask me another time what that's about. Or a lot of you folks know can explain it. Then he warned the disciples that they should tell no one that he was the Messiah. From that time, Yeshua began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised up on the third day. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord, this will never happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interest, but man's. I'm going to take a little rabbi trail in verse 23. You know, to be satanic, does it mean you have to be wicked? or evil, or rebellious, or immoral. To be satanic, all you have to do is things your way. Because that's what Satan did. And that's what Peter's doing. Let me drive that home again. To truly align yourself with Satan, you don't have to be immoral. You don't have to be rebellious. You don't have to be wicked and evil and mean and ugly and all these other things. All you have to do is do things your way, which I guess is rebellious. And your way could be a good way. It could be a way that it seems really good, you know, and it's not immoral. It just seems like a good way to go. But Solomon warns us, this is the way it seems right to man, but the ends thereof are the death ways, the ways of death. So to align yourself with Satan, all you have to do is do things your way. And that's what Yeshua is saying. Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interest, but Satan's, no, but man's. In other words, Peter, you're thinking man's ways and not God's ways. And he calls him Satan. Satan just simply did things his way. And when you do things your way, guess who you're aligning yourself with? So we have a choice. We can do things God's way, or we can do things our way. And Satan's perfectly happy with that, because our way is his way. You understand? Okay, bunny trail over. Let's get back to this passage. I want to take this overhead off for a moment. And I want us to move to this. We've seen that the one person in the scriptures called the Kohelet is who? Solomon, who wrote Ecclesiastes, Kohelet. Now, if you ask a Christian, who is the son of David? They'll say, Jesus. If you ask a Jew, who is the son of David? They will say, Solomon. Correct? You see, Solomon is a picture of Yeshua. He's a picture of Messiah. His kingdom is a picture of Messiah's kingdom. Let me give you a little bit of background. Oh, my goodness. I'm going to do it fast. I'm going to do it anyway. The two sons of David. Here's David. There's David's name. We've looked at it a few times as we've gone through Genesis. It's spelled Dalet Vav Dalet. And the numeric value of David's name is 4 plus 6 plus 4. Dalet's the fourth letter. Vav, the middle letters, were 6. 4, 6, and 4 add up to 14. This is why in the first chapter of Matthew, Matthew is saying from Abraham to David is 14 generations. From David until the carrying away into Babylon is 14 generations. And then from the carrying away to Babylon until Messiah is 14 generations. Why is he doing this? Because his gospel is there to show that Yeshua is the king, the son of David. And so he breaks up the genealogy into groups of 14, because 14 is the numerical value of David's name. Also, Jewish people who have been reading this would have recognized another fact. You know, the Hebrew calendar is a lunar calendar for the most part, and everything is decided by the phases of the moon. Now, they all know that the phase of the moon takes 28 plus one day, 29 days. So you start with no light, and maybe just the beginning of a new moon. That's Abraham. Abraham's on the scene, and God's begin to pour out his truth through a man. And you go 14 days, you've got a full moon. You go 14 generations, you have David, you see? Full moon. And who's David's son? Solomon. I mean, no wars, prosperity everywhere. It was an incredible time. Amazing time. The temple is built. And God's glory fills the temple. The ark is brought into the temple. Amazing, amazing time. And Solomon, his name is Shlomo in Hebrew. There it is, Shlomo. And it comes from the word shalom, peace. And of course, Yeshua, he is the Sar Shalom, the Prince of Peace. So we have the full moon. But then you go 14 generations, and now the moon is gone. That's carrying away into Babylon. Okay, 14 days later. And then you go another 14 days, and you come back up to a full moon, and that's Yeshua. 14. You see how it's working? All right. Another thing, and I'm sure it's purely coincidence, I mentioned that Dalet Vav Dalet is 4, 6, and 4. Now, that letter Vav in the middle, in Hebrew there's no word for and. What you do for and is you stick a Vav onto something. You stick it in the front of a word, it means and. So you could read this as 4 and 4. You'll notice Yeshua's name has 4 letters, and Shlomo's name also just happens to have 4 letters. You see, these are the sons of David. One, the physical son with a physical kingdom, with a physical temple. The other is also a physical son, but he came as a spiritual deliverer, a spiritual kingdom, a spiritual temple. And when he returns, the two are brought together. Okay? And he will sit on the throne of David, of David. All right, so there's the background. Let's move on. We have Yeshua, we have Solomon. They're both called son of David. But Solomon builds a physical temple, and Yeshua is building a spiritual temple, a spiritual house. Because the temple usually is referred to as a house in Scripture. And Yeshua is the chief cornerstone. He's the architect. He's the foundation. He's the master builder. We're the building materials, and we are also his fellow builders. It's a team effort. But he is the Messiah. He's the head. Where did Solomon build his temple? Bethel. The place where Jacob started off from, where he had the dream of the ladder. And what did he say when he left Bethel the first time? This is very important to understand. When he left Bethel the first time, if you go back to chapter 28, I believe, what did Jacob say after he saw the ladder, they had the dream? Verse 16, Genesis 28:16. Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, "Surely Adonai is present in this place, and I did not know it." And he became frightened and said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the abode of God, and this is the gate of the heavens." And there are other proof texts we can use to show that Bethel was actually the threshing floor where Abraham offered Isaac as the place where the temple was built. We'll leave the right column for a moment. Let's just continue down the left column. So we read Genesis 28, verses 16 and 17, the revelation about the place. This is the place. How awesome is this place? This is the gate of heaven. God's in this place, and I didn't know it. And then we fast forward centuries, and we come to 1 Kings 8. I love this passage. You want to have a wonderful time. Just go to 1 Kings chapter 8. It's a long chapter. But this is Solomon, who's just completed the temple. And he's blessing God. He's blessing the people. And it's just an incredible chapter. Amazing chapter. But if you go to 1 Kings chapter 8, we need to look at a few verses. And then we'll start tying all this together. And hopefully, it'll all make sense. And if it doesn't, we'll try again next week. All right, 1 Kings chapter 8. And we'll just read a few verses. Start with verse 12. "Then Solomon said, 'The Lord has said that he would dwell in the thick cloud. I have surely built you a lofty house, a place for your dwelling forever.' Then the king faced about and blessed all the assembly of Israel, while all the assembly of Israel was standing." Notice Israel, his use of the word Israel here. "He said, 'Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who spoke with his mouth to my father David, and has fulfilled it with his hand, saying, Since the day that I brought my people Israel from Egypt, I did not choose a city out of all the tribes of Israel in which to build a house that my name might be there, but I chose David to be over my people Israel. Now it was in my heart, in the heart of my father David, to build a house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. But the Lord Adonai said to my father David, because it was in your heart to build a house for my name, you did well that it was in your heart. Nevertheless, you shall not build the house, but your son who will be born to you, he will build the house for my name. Now the Lord fulfilled his word which he spoke, for I have risen in the place of my father David, and sit on the throne of Israel, as Adonai promised, and have built the house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. There I have set a place for the ark, in which is the covenant of the Lord, which he made with our forefathers, when he brought them from the land of Egypt. And as you go on, you're going to find the word kahal used 5 times in Solomon's prayer, praising God for the kahal, the called assembly that had come together in Jerusalem, the people of Israel, to worship God at his holy temple. And as you read on through, you're going to find that the temple was completed with countless sacrifices. Back in verse 5 it says, "And King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who were assembled to him were with them before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and oxen they could not be counted or numbered." This is as they bring the ark to the temple. Once the ark was in the temple, it tells us they sacrificed 22,000 oxen, 120,000 sheep. On the left side, you see the son of David, Shlomo, whose name means peace, who built the temple at Bethel. On the right, you see another son of David, the prince of peace, the one who's the king of Israel like no king. And there's a revelation there as well. There was a revelation in Genesis 28 where Jacob says, "God is in this place. I didn't know it. Certainly this is the gate of the heavens." But what does Yeshua say? Now we're ready to go back to Matthew 16. And look at this passage in a slightly different light. In Matthew 16 and 17, Yeshua is asking, "Who do you say that I am?" Matthew 16, 16, Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Yeshua said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." See the connection? The location of the first temple came by revelation to Jacob. The revelation of the other son of David, who he is, and what he's about to build, also came by revelation, not by flesh and blood, but by the Father in heaven. Now let's look at the kahal. In 1 Kings chapter 8, verses 12 to 21, we see the word kahal used. And 5 times in chapter 8, everybody's assembled there, come together, to build this place. And who built it? The Kohelet. Solomon, Shlomo, is the Kohelet. He's the one who wrote the book Kohelet. So we go on to Matthew, verse 18. "I also say to you that you are Petrus, and upon this rock I will build my kahal, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it." Jacob said, "This is the gates of heaven." And Yeshua says, "I'm going to build my kahal on this rock." What rock? Caesarea Philippi? No. It's not a physical rock. It's a spiritual one. And he says, "The gates of hell, the gates of Hades, of Sheol, will not prevail against it." The gates of death, in other words. And he goes on to say, "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven." Then he warned the disciples that they tell no one that he was the Messiah. Well, wait a minute. If he's building this great kahal, if he's the Messiah, she wouldn't be telling everybody? No, because then that would be flesh and blood revealing it. Yeshua wanted the revelation of who he was not to come through flesh and blood, but by his Father in heaven. There would be time later on to go and tell people. But right now, he is starting the most subtle of ways, the most secret of ways, the very opposite of how Solomon was. I mean, when they were working that temple, you saw the temple, you could not miss it. It was up on top of a mountain, and I mean, it was the highest structure, and you could see it for miles. But here, Yeshua is building something here that doesn't appear to sight at all. The temple Solomon built required countless sacrifices, plus 22,000 oxen, 120,000 sheep. But the temple commenced by Yeshua, only one sacrifice, and he introduces that in verse 21. "From that time, Yeshua began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised up on the third day." See the difference? The differences are so opposite each other, it's easy to miss the fact that they form a menorah and that they balance each other. The two sons of David, Shlomo and Yeshua. Now, everything I've said so far is introduction. Now, this is the real teaching here. Let's go to Ephesians. You laugh now. Let's go to Ephesians and take a... Well, while you're looking into for Ephesians, I want to show you something really cool. I mentioned earlier that we are partners with Messiah in the building, right? I mean, Solomon did not build the temple single-handedly. He's the one who oversaw it and provided the materials. But he had a team, an army of people, a cabal of people doing the building. Yeshua the same way. And Paul in chapter 3, that we had, 1 Corinthians 3 that we read during the prayer service, he's talking about how we all build on this foundation. There's no other foundation. We need to be careful how we build on it. Well, back in our chapter that we're supposed to be studying tonight, in chapter 35, you'll notice it lists Jacob's sons this way. It says the sons of Leah, list them, sons of Rachel, list them, sons of Bilhah, sons of Zilpah. But in the next chapter, it lists the sons of Esau. And look how it does it there. It doesn't say the sons of Ada. It says Ada bore, and then names the sons. And Basemath bore. And Oholibama, who obviously was a Democrat, bore. And so you ask the question, why are Esau's wives and sons worded one way and Jacob's are the other? And the Baal HaTorim, the great rabbi of a couple centuries ago, said, well, you know, the word for son is the word ben, and the word for build, you just add an aleph on, bana, to build. And he said, Jacob's wives were co-builders. Esau's wives weren't. Who's the bride of Messiah? Who's the bride of the heavenly Solomon? Who's the bride of the true son of David? We are. And we help to bana. We are the ones who help to build. You get the difference? All right. Hope you found Ephesians by now. Okay. Here we go. I call Ephesians our adoption papers. And what we're going to do is take a real flyover of Ephesians. And hopefully this book's going to come alive. And you're going to see the kahal, the church, in a light that is precious and new. And you'll never look at it the same again. Here's our present status, especially us as Gentile believers. It says in verse 5, he predestined us to adoption as sons through Yeshua the Messiah to himself, according to the kind intention of his will, to the praise of the glory of his grace, which he freely bestowed on us in the Beloved. That's our present status. That's wonderful, isn't it? It's so wonderful that we may not grasp it. In fact, I know we don't. So Paul prays down a few verses further. He says in verse 18, I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened so that you will know what is the hope of his calling, what are the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints, and what is the surpassing greatness of his power toward us who believe. These are in accordance with the working of the strength of his might. And you've got to understand something else here. That word saint, not a New Testament word. Abraham was a saint, Noah was a saint, Jacob was a saint, Isaac was a saint. All these godly men and women of the Tanakh were considered the Kodeshim, the holy ones, the saints, were grafted in with them. Saints aren't these little guys you put on your dashboard or you see in cathedrals. These are men and women. These are the men and women of faith from Genesis on. So, without God's help, we cannot comprehend the great salvation, the great kahal that he's made us a part of. We can't do it. And we need to pray this prayer that Paul prayed. Pray for ourselves. God, open the eyes of my understanding so I can begin to grasp how great a work you've done. The mighty privilege you've lavished upon me. Just how great is this kahal? Verses 22-23. He put all things in subjection under his feet and gave him, Yeshua, as head over all things to the kahal, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. That's powerful stuff. You say, I don't quite get it? Well, then go back and pray the prayer, okay? Okay. And one of the things that makes it almost too incredible to believe is how dark our past was. So you look at chapter 2, verses 1 to 7. It says, "And you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked, according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, among them of the spirit that is now working the sons of disobedience." And to just for sake of time, you can read those seven verses. But it's we were in bad shape. But in verse 10, it says, "For we are his workmanship, created in Messiah Yeshua for good works, which God prepared beforehand so that we would walk in them." This is a direct reference back to the Kohelet, the original Solomon, the original preacher. When you read the book of Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, he says, "I'm the one, the summoner. I'm the one who's calling the assembly." And that for 12 chapters, he tells us how futile life under the sun is in this physical world. And life here is just futile. And then you read through this, you're getting more and more depressed as you go through. And you come to the very last two verses of Ecclesiastes. And this is what they are. The closing two verses. This is what Solomon the Kohelet, the preacher, says. "The conclusion when all has been heard is, fear God, keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act of judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil." There's his conclusion. Fear God, keep his commandments. Now what does it say here? Why were we saved? Why did God bring us Gentiles into the Kohol? "For we are his workmanship, created in Messiah Yeshua for good works, which God prepared beforehand." They're all found in the Torah, so that we would walk in them. And here are rights of membership that's adopted into this family. "Therefore remember that formerly you, the Gentiles in the flesh, who are called the uncircumcision by the so-called circumcision which is performed in the flesh of human hands, remember," verse 12, "that you were at that time, A, separate from Messiah, B, excluded from the commonwealth of Israel, C, strangers to the covenants of promise, D, having no hope, and E, without God in the world." That's the way we were. "But now, in Messiah Yeshua, you who were formerly were far off have been brought near by the blood of Messiah." So you take the opposite of those five things. Now we're not separate from Messiah. We're joined to him. We're now included in the commonwealth of Israel. We are not strangers to the covenants of promise. Those covenants of promise are now our covenants. We now have hope, and we now have God in the world. Wonderful, isn't it? Verse 14, "For he himself is our shalom." Shalomo, Solomon, this peace. He is our shalom. "Who made both groups, Jew and Gentile, into one, and broke down the barrier wall, the mekitza, the dividing wall." That wall in the temple that was not supposed to be there wasn't in Solomon's temple. But the temple's later, the wall that was later added to keep the Gentiles out. That wall was not there to keep the Jews in. It was there to keep the Gentiles out. He says, that's been done away with. We now can come in. His temple is our temple. His covenants and promises are ours. The commonwealth of Israel is our commonwealth as well. And then we address the temple. Verse 17. "And he came and he preached peace to you who were far away, and peace to those who were near. For through him we both, Jew and Gentile, have our access in one spirit to the Father. So then you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and are of God's kohol, his household. Having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Messiah Yeshua himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole building being fitted together is growing into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together into a dwelling of God in the Spirit." Amazing. Solomon built a temple. Yeshua is building one. And we're part of that. We're builders and we're building materials both, if you can imagine. Now the secret's revealed. Chapter 3, verse 1. For this reason, I, Paul, the prisoner of Messiah Yeshua, for the sake of you Gentiles, if indeed you have heard of the stewardship of God's grace, which is given to me for you, that by revelation there was made known to me the secret, as I wrote before in brief. By referring to this, when you read, you can understand my insight into the secret of Messiah, which in other generations was not made known to the sons of men, as is now being revealed to his holy apostles and prophets of the Spirit. To be specific, here's the secret, that the Gentiles are fellow heirs and fellow members of the body, and fellow partakers of the promise in Messiah Yeshua through the gospel. It's not just the promise of salvation. No. It's the promise of being completely included as full members, enjoying full privileges in the commonwealth of Israel, so that everything God has given Israel as a blessing is ours as well. Everything. You understand how God is grafting Gentiles into the Kahal? He's not trying to graft Jews into the church. Now, that's another issue. That raises its own set of questions. But we have one more prayer by Paul in this wonderful book. Verse 14. For this reason I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name, that he would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in the inner man, so that Messiah may dwell in your hearts through faith, and that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend all with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Messiah, which surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled up to all the fullness of God. You see what he's doing? He's describing a temple. That's us. Temples have length and width and depth. So does this temple. But it's not physical with length, width, and depth. It can only be comprehended by revelation of God's Spirit. In other words, it has nothing to do with size. It's a totally spiritual thing. Verse 20, now to him who is able to do far more abundantly beyond all that we ask or think. How sad it is, most believers I know don't think God could do half of what they hope and think. Isn't that true? Aren't we guilty of that? We don't think God can do half of what we ask or hope or think or look for. It says, now to him who is able to do far more abundantly beyond all that we ask or think, according to the power that works within us, to him be the glory in the Kahal and in Messiah Yeshua to all generations forever and ever. Amen. Is that a little bit different picture of the church than you've ever had before? I hope it is. Because it is a very scriptural one. We'll close with this wonderful verse, Psalm 149, verses 1 and 2. Praise Adonai. Sing to Adonai a new song. Praise him in the Kahal of the godly. Let Israel rejoice in their Creator. Let the people of Zion delight in their King. You know what? The Jewish people from ancient times have loved the church, because they knew what it really was. And we're getting a greater revelation even of what it is. But so many people, they think a church is a building with a pointy thing on top filled with people who really just can't wait to get to the restaurant at noon. You know? And it's something glorious and wonderful that we've been grafted into. And it's being built by Messiah. And we are his partners in building it. Okay? So, you know what? We've gone way over time. And so if you have questions or comments, I'll just invite you to come up and share them, and we'll stay up here and yak. But let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time together. And I pray, Lord, that you'll take all these words, all these verses we've looked at, and Lord, weave them together into something that makes sense, something that will stay with us and will just grow in us. It will have a new love for your Kahal, your ecclesia, your church. Whatever language, Lord, it is something wonderful and glorious. So, Lord, I pray you would open the eyes of understanding. Help us to comprehend the greatness of what you're doing and the fact that we are a part of it. Help us to not get so bogged down with our petty existence in this world. And, Lord, begin to arise and be the people you want us to be. for it's a glorious life and a glorious existence that you've given us. Help us to fulfill our mission here. And we'll give you all the praise and glory for it. In Yeshua's name, amen.